Bon, bonjour à toutes et à tous. Bienvenue à nouveau à notre colloque « Qu'est-ce qu'une révolution politique ?». Nous allons donc démarrer la session de l'après-midi avec Jack Goldstone, qui est professeur de public policy à George Mason University et qui nous présentera une communication intitulée « Revolution is the forcible overthrow of a government through mass mobilization, whether military or civilian or both, in the name of social justice to create new political institutions. »
Thank you, Federico. It's a great honor to join you here today to celebrate the installation of Yad Ben-Achur as Chair of Studies for the Francophone World. And we are discussing the nature of revolutions, which is only fitting as Dr. Ben-Achur is not only a world-class constitutional scholar, but has been a leading actor in one of the major revolutionary waves of this century. Now, I would say the most important thing to keep in mind is that a revolution is not a single event. It's a complex process involving thousands of people in different places at different times, conducting a struggle for power that can last for years, even decades. How do we define such an event? Scholars have differed by focusing their definitions on different parts of this complex process. Some have focused on the breakdown of the existing government. Some have cited the presence of mass violence. Others have pointed to mass mobilization. Some to a marked change of regime. Others focus on a radical ideology. For my own work, I've chosen to define a revolution as the forcible overthrow of a government through mass mobilization, whether military or civilian or both, very importantly, in the name of social justice, in order to create new political institutions. Now, I've chosen this definition for the purpose of separating revolution from other kinds of power struggles that commonly occur. For example, revolutions overlap with and are similar to civil wars, coup d'etat, peasant uprisings, even imperial collapse, and some kinds of succession all overlap with revolution. What my definition tries to do is focus on the opening stage of the revolutionary process. It takes for granted that there will then be diverse struggles and varying outcomes as revolutions unfold. But I do have what I think are the distinctive elements of political revolutions. First, the government leaving power against its will, whether that's the result of peaceful mass protest, a violent war, guerrilla warfare, but the government being forced out of power. Second, there must be mass mobilization, not just an elite coup d'etat. People must be involved, whether as soldiers or protesters or rioters. Finally, the struggle for power must have a moral vision and end in the creation of new political institutions. Otherwise, if it's just a struggle to capture the existing political institutions, that is typical of a civil war. So we have a definition, but what is the goal of having a definition? Well, as I said, it separates political revolutions from other kinds of power struggle. But still, you may think this is unsatisfactory because this definition does not tell us how long a revolution will last. It doesn't tell us who will win. It doesn't tell us what the outcome will be. But I feel I have to leave those open because it would be a mistake to believe we can constrain revolutions with a definition. as if they had an unchanging character or a fixed identity. The key thing to recognize about revolutions, they're complex, they are contingent, they have emergent properties. Things happen, as we've said this morning, things happen that you could not predict or foresee. And of course, revolutions differ greatly among themselves. Knowing that an event is a revolution, therefore, tells us little, but not enough. It does not tell us, once a power struggle has begun, what will happen next. Because power struggles have their own dynamics. The outcome depends on which groups gain support, what resources they can command, what kinds of conflicts, battles, or negotiations occur, what foreign powers get engaged. There may be temporary victors who are then swept aside, or there may be negotiations, as with Tunisia, that create an uneasy peace, but not real stability. Now, for too long, I believe historical imagination and much scholarship was captured by one particular kind of revolution, the great social revolutions. But in fact, many other kinds of revolutions have produced important regime changes. Now, the great social revolution is what we think of generally when you hear the word revolution. This involves a lengthy mobilization, a civil war, usually a period of terror, a new constitutionally defined government, sweeping changes in the distribution of property, and a radical change in the dominant ideology. But events that combine all of these elements have been historically rare. Though I should say, since I'm in Paris, that it's only fair to note that France has had more of these great revolutions than most countries. From the epic revolution of 1789, one could also go to the Paris Commune of 1870-71, and of course France's involvement in the revolutions in Vietnam and Algeria. Still, looking only at the great social revolutions gives a very narrow and distorted view of revolutions. As I mentioned, other kinds of revolutions produce important regime changes. European politics were completely transformed by the collapse of the Soviet Union and its affiliated communist regimes in Eastern Europe and Mongolia. Yet the overthrow of communism occurred by predominantly peaceful revolutions that led to the resignation of communist leaders and the creation of new governments. In fact, where violence was most extreme in this process, as in Chechnya in the Caucasus, there was no new national government, no new national revolution, just a new local regime still under control of the Russian Federation. So the revolutions against communism illustrate two important features that are not always evident in studies of the great social revolutions. First, revolutions are usually not isolated events. They occur usually as part of international waves, with revolutions in some countries triggering and shaping revolutions in others. And second, that revolutions have enormously varied outcomes. Even the revolutions against communist rule, all fighting more or less against the same type of regime, produced a huge variety of outcomes. There were some stable democracies in the Baltic countries, Mongolia, some partial democracies in Eastern and Southeastern Europe, and there were some highly unstable democracies that had multiple subsequent revolutions, such as in Ukraine and Kyrgyzstan. And of course, a few of the post-Soviet states became full dictatorships, as in Russia, Azerbaijan, and Kazakhstan. It's also important and often overlooked that revolutions are usually not isolated, but play an important role in shaping global and regional history through the phenomenon of waves. For example, the revolution in Haiti, the anti-slave revolt in Haiti in the early 19th century, was long overlooked among the studies of great revolutions. But it's now considered by scholars as a singularly important event. It tied together the revolution in France with the revolutions of independence in Latin America and gave a impetus to anti-slavery movements all over the world. It may by itself have only been a revolution in a small country, which one could also say of Tunisia, but the consequences were global. And this is why it's important not to see revolutions in isolation, but to take them in their full global context. Now, the Middle East has been racked by a series of revolutions. Interestingly, the revolutions that we've seen in 2010, 2011 were revolutions against regimes that were themselves the creation of earlier revolutions. That is, the regimes that were overthrown in 2010, 2011 in Tunisia, Egypt, and Algeria initially took shape in revolutions against colonial powers. And the revolutions in Libya, Syria, and Yemen took place against revolutionary parties that had come to power in previous revolutions of their own. So revolutions can build upon themselves over time. It was a bizarre mistake that many scholars of the Arab world said, oh, there haven't been revolutions in the Arab world for decades. Therefore, absolutism has somehow become a feature of Arab regimes. And then everyone was shocked when revolutions occurred again. And yet, if you're an expert in revolutions, it's easy to point out every country that had a revolution in 2010, 2011 had had previous revolutions in their history. The idea that Arab countries, or for that matter, that any countries are somehow immune from revolution is usually the result of not looking deep enough or far enough back. Now, revolutions can also go on for an ungodly length of time. If we look east to Afghanistan, we see a country that has remained in a revolutionary state that began with the overthrow of the monarchy in 1978, but which never produced a stable government in the years since. Instead, the Afghan revolution produced a long series of civil wars, a communist regime, an Islamist regime, a strange hybrid of kind of Western support for democracy in Kabul with warlord rule elsewhere in the country, and now, after the withdrawal of the United States, another Islamist regime. 54 years of revolutionary conflict without a clear resolution. Meanwhile, the outcomes of the revolutionary wave that moved from Tunisia to Egypt to Libya to Syria to Yemen remains unclear. The latter three countries remain in the throes of civil war. Egypt is under the heel of a repressive counter-revolution. And Tunisia, which preserved democracy through many compromises and conflicts, is now teetering on the brink of a return to autocracy. So what do definitions of revolution provide? Not as much as we would like, I think it's only fair to say. Now, definitions are still useful. They constrain possibilities. So it's very useful to know if an animal is a mammal or a fish. That tells you what you're looking at to some degree. But you can say this animal is a mammal, and it could be a shrew or it could be a whale, because mammals are enormously varied, even though they do share common features. Revolutions have an almost similar range of variety. We can't fix or constrain We cannot fix or constrain revolutions with a definition. What we need to understand are the varieties of revolution and how those different types of revolution are related to each other, how they have evolved across regions, and how they have developed across global history. That brings us to the question that I think concerns all of us at some point. We say, can you be objective about revolutions? Are revolutions necessary, or are they tragic and avoidable? Some scholars have argued, particularly I have to say American scholars in the 20th century, influenced by functionalism and the status quo with a dominant United States, they defined revolutions as dangerous and costly and tragic events that could have been and should have been avoided. In this view, a healthy government is a stable government, and revolutions represent a failure, some kind of deadly rupture in the proper operation of a society, produced when extreme ideologies and radical leaders come to the fore. But other scholars, and especially revolutionary leaders, both Marxist and democratic, they have a different view. They say that revolutions are normal and necessary episodes to create social change, without which vital social development could not occur. Just as caterpillars must end their existence and go through radical change to become butterflies, so monarchies and dictatorships must go through revolutionary crises if they're going to emerge as free and democratic societies. Revolutions are thus necessary agents of social change, as inevitable and necessary to societal evolution as births and deaths are necessary to the evolution of species. Can a definition of revolutions solve this problem for us and give us the value judgment? I don't believe so, because I think when you study the great variety of revolutions in their full global context, we see that some revolutions were tragic and avoidable, but others were inevitable and necessary. We can argue about which cases are which, perhaps, in the discussion. Ask me about your favorites. But I do think we see both across the broad range of history. What we need to do is place revolutions in a multi-layered history and say, what waves of revolutions were these events parts of? What variety of revolution were they, and how did they evolve? What changes to subsequent regimes and global relations did they create? We are only at the beginning of this task, as I think for too long, a small subset of events, the great social revolutions, captured our attention. But progress is underway. Scholarship now is focusing on nonviolent revolutions, on the history of waves of revolution, where they occurred, transformations they've created. We're seeing a combination of international relations and the study of revolutions that really did not exist 10 or 20 years ago. But we must still be prepared, as with evolution, to see new types and varieties of revolution emerge. Because one of the elements of revolutions we cannot forget is that human beings make revolutions, and therefore human creativity drives the evolution of new types of revolution and new outcomes. And that is the process that I hope we will come to understand. Thank you.